Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from the unceded territory of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial. I'm Jesse. It's Thursday, and it's time for talking. Well, mostly talking. We'll also, as usual, have a little bit of music and things, but the main feature on today's program is an interview conducted by Public Affairs Department volunteer Florentina with Jessica Chan of Rice Paper. And we'll have some other things too, depending on timing, etc. I'm not going to say just what they are yet, because there's still some moving pieces. We are going to start with a little music, and we're going to break tradition and not start with something local. And instead, I'm feeling nostalgic, so we're going to hear a song by the American band Built to Spill, who are currently in the midst of a big West Coast tour through the end of September. Well, Western United States tour, I guess. They get off the coast into Texas and New Mexico and Colorado, but not playing here, which is always a bummer. So it goes. They're at the Seattle Park Zoo on August 18th, or the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, at 10 a.m. on August 18th, if you want to go check them out. Anyway, this track is from the record Perfect From Now On, and it's called Randy Described Eternity.
Thank you.
CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC, striving to provide points of view that are rarely expressed in mainstream media.
Hello, listeners. My name is Florentina, and last week I had the true pleasure of joining 2026 Literary Asians panel talking about the legacy of Jim Wong Chu in the Asian Canadian literary movement, which featured the panelists that I'm honored to be joined with today, Jessica Jinjade Chan. Jessica here is the former editor-in-chief for BC's own Rice Paper magazine and is currently serving as the director for the board of the Federation of Asian Canadian Lawyers. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Florentina.
Just to start things off with, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I guess you've said my name. My name is Jessica Chan, and I am actually a lawyer who's out in Toronto. Mm-hmm. So I practice mergers and acquisitions law off of Bay Street, and I guess I do this in my spare time. So thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. My life before law was as an editor of Rice Paper magazine, and I took over Rice Paper right around the troubled years. Mm-hmm. So I would say probably in the early noughties to the late 2000s, that's when I was involved. Mm-hmm. And I am involved with the Ontario chapter of the Federation of Asian Canadian Lawyers. Don't want the BC chapter to be a little upset at me. So there you go.
Yeah.
In terms of background, my background is in law currently, and my previous background would have been in publishing, so I'm very thrilled to be back at SFU. Mm-hmm. I did take the master's in publishing here, so it's been a while since I've been on the mountain, but it's lovely to be back.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Prior to that, I was in creative writing.
Just to start things off with, in that case, do you find that there's like an overlap with the work you do now, with the work you've done previously as an editor? I think I have it written here, in fact. Having done so many literary reviews for Rice Paper, what keeps drawing you back to writing, to reviewing writing?
Storytelling.
Yeah.
Right? I think there's just so much to be said in terms of the stories that every person has to tell. Mm-hmm. And it's always very exciting. Like, even if you're writing a LinkedIn post now, there's a storytelling narrative to that. Mm-hmm. Or in speaking publicly, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're trying to make your client's case in court, there's usually some kind of narrative there. So I always find it very interesting to find what gets to the root of the human psyche. Mm-hmm. And it's always a bit more interesting when you couch someone's issue or problem in something that matters to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of where the overlap is. And I suppose because Jim Wong Chu was my mentor, it's very difficult to not be involved with the community somehow or want to be, right? Mm-hmm. So interestingly, I did not realize that Jim's influence on me, even as a lawyer, still continues today, because even though he was my writing and publishing mentor, let's say the work I do with the Federation of Asian Canadian Lawyers, we are also, you know, in the business of promoting Asian lawyers in the legal field, not very different from promoting Asian writers in the literary field, right? Like, the focus is still on our community.
Yeah.
And I think my heart's still there.
Yeah, just a little bit more on your work with Rice Paper then. If you don't mind me asking, well, how did you first get involved? How did you first meet Jim, and how did you kind of get closer as you continued working together?
I don't think I was supposed to. Like, so what happened was, back then, Rice Paper had a different editor. Mm-hmm. And my very good friend from my creative writing days from UVic, Hanako Masatani, she was working Rice Paper as a volunteer. And so she called me up out of the blue one day, because I had moved to Vancouver then. I was working my master's in publishing. And she said, hey, Rice Paper had a fire. Come on down. We need your help. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the joke goes that I thought it was a literal fire, you know, bringing buckets and everything. But it turns out that the previous editor had run off with all the money and taken off the staff. So I think we were left with maybe four or five of volunteers. And when you consider initially about 40 volunteers, that's a huge difference. So, of course, you do not meet Jim anywhere other than a Chinese restaurant or a congee restaurant. And there was four or five of us sitting around the round table. And Jim just looked at me and said, okay, you're it. And I think the only reason is because I had this publishing thing I was studying, right? Uh-huh. I wasn't even a graduate at the point. And he's just said, okay, we need someone to get us started from the roots. So I wasn't an editor from the very beginning. My heart was in storytelling. It's always been because of the creative writing background. But Jim wasn't going to let me touch the editorial. I think he had learned the hard way. that, you know, you need to have strong operations. So when I look back, he was very wise to do so. But back then, I was resentful because it's, I mean, you're volunteering, and he said, "Okay, now you're gonna do. You're gonna be the business manager." And I'm thinking, "What?
Yeah,
I have no clue how to run a business." Then after the business development phase, he said, "Okay, now you're gonna do circulation. Now you're gonna do advertising." So I pretty much did every single field while dabbling and working on editorial, until the point he decided I was ready to be the editor in chief. And that took a while. So because the previous editor had absconded, there were a number of issues where he had completed but were not released onto newsstands yet. Mm-hmm. So we had to hold them and release them on the newsstands in bits and pieces, because we had to resolve certain issues with the printers and the funders and our like stakeholders. And I mean, now I guess it doesn't matter anymore, but back then it was a very sensitive topic. So interestingly, because of that little gap, right, so you would see like magazines released with his name on it, but that was a time when I was working with Jim operationally to get the magazine back on track behind the scenes. So by the time the first one was released with my name as an editor, several months, if not a whole year, had passed. And so the very first magazine was under my name, was volume 8.4. So volumes 1, 2, 3 were with a different editor, and volume 8.4 is the first one that I wrote a co-editorial with Hanako Masutani. So we were both executive editors at that point, not EIC. And when you look at the 8.4 volume, you see a detraction from the previous issues. Back then, because Rice Paper was released as a print quarterly, we try to make sure every series, like volume 8, volume 7, etc., had a certain look, had a certain theme. Partly because Rice Paper started as a publication with rotating guest editors.
Yeah.
So every editor wanted to put their imprint on it. And partly also because nobody really stayed that long. It was a volunteer-run organization, right? So the previous editor had a visual arts background. I think he was also a curator of sorts. So it was very interesting. He had a different vision, and he ran the magazine as though each issue was going to be an art gallery.
Oh.
So each issue had a theme. I think 8.1 was technology, 8.2 was a touch issue, 8.3 was colloquially known as a Hapa issue, but a tagline was, you know, end of pure race. So it was a little contentious. Anyways, we got some very interesting letters to the editor from that, which we had to sort out after. So when you look at 8.4, though, it gets away from this thematic issue, which is the one we started, and goes towards a more traditional magazine format. So it had things like, you know, clear front of the book, right? You have editorial, masthead, you have like columns, you have departments. So I introduced things like very clear delineation of every department had to represent a certain type of art. So you had performing arts, you had maybe theater, which is not the same as performing arts, because performing arts was a broader category for stand-up comedians, you know, spoken word, etc. You had a literary area. So literary was then split later in later years to fiction, nonfiction, poetry, etc. You had art news, which was Jim's way of connecting the entire community with what's going on in the world of Canadian, Asian Canadian arts. And you had something called Coast to Coast, which was a collection of pictures from people from Victoria all the way to like PEI, Halifax, right? St. John's, saying these are things happening as Asian Canadians, what have we done? And so that very first issue was the start of this kind of look. And of course, we had the features, right? And the features we had, I believe Roy Ma was featured for that very issue. And Roy Ma is a bit of a cultural hero, right? Because he's the person who basically said, hey, you know, Chinese who have never been able to vote deserve citizenship because we fought in the Canadian military in World War II. And, you know, Down with Exclusion Act, right? Give us our rights. And so he's a bit of a hero. So Rice Paper, even though it wasn't a very openly direct activist publication, there was always some element of soft activism. So when I say soft activism, I mean, it's not, you know, we're not going to publish an essay on maybe those topics, only on like Exclusion Act and head tax. But we will maybe publish an interview that, you know, is about a documentarian who's done work on this, right? Or maybe a feature on someone in the community who's done that. So I think a lot of those early years for me and Jim were about establishing that community and giving that visibility on the newsstands to people across Canada, because rice paper was distributed nationally. So I think when you see the shift on our covers, right, our covers started looking a lot less literary. We started featuring like a face each time. And the goal was to bring more prominent Asian Canadians into the cover. So for example, like in the years when I was editor, we had David Suzuki, we had Margaret Cho, you know, we had like Tommy Chong came after, we had Kate Rigg, you know, people that were already leading in the Asian Canadian community. And we then Jim and I thought, you know, it's good to give them that limelight. And at the same time, we also brought in the emerging artists, right? Because now that you have the people who are leading, more people want to be featured. So I think someone once said back in the days, you know, every great Asian Canadian artist starts out by being featured somewhere in rice paper. And that was kind of the intention to establish that. I think I've rambled on for a while. But
really beautiful. I feel like I can see, especially like your storytelling background, how that kind of translates in how rice paper has evolved when you were executive editing and when you were EIC as well. In the panel, you kind of mentioned also a kind of like a predecessor to rice paper as well, which was the Asian Canadian, which I actually hadn't been familiar with. On top of like Asian Canadian, there were also like a few newspapers as well, I'm sure, like the Chinese Times. And I was just wondering if there were any direct influences or inspirations that you took in how you curated rice paper.
So Asian Canadian was published in, I think, in 1978, and I think it ran for 7 or 8 issues and ended in sometime in the 80s. So the founder was Chuck Wan. I know him out in Toronto. And I think he had a co-founder as well, so my apologies. I don't know who that was. But Asian Canadian was very much more of an activist publication. So there were a lot of issues back in the 70s, right? I mean, there was a Vietnam War, various other things going on as well. And I think they found it that it was a necessary publication to talk about these issues and bring all the Asian community together, because there wasn't an English publication. So I believe back then Chuck had actually said something about wanting to have a publication that was both in Mandarin and English. He thought, okay, let's do this. And he thought, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense, because if you can read English, you're not reading Mandarin, and vice versa. So they struck the Mandarin part and said, you know, all of us are people who speak English, there isn't really anything like this out there. We need a community and a forum. So I think over the years they had things like the youth issue, there was the LGBTQ plus issue, the themes, right? And I think every time there would be different guest editors, and they ran as an editorial collective. So that's the difference between Asian Canadian and Rice Paper, because I ran Rice Paper more like a business, because we were going for visibility, capacity building back in the day, right? And Asian Canadian was more a group of people of like mind getting together and saying, this is what this issue is going to look like. So the content was different, because they were more focused on current affairs, nonfiction, essays, activism, right? Things affecting our community. And Rice Paper was more about literary arts and culture, which is why I insist on those departments being very clear. There should be one for music, theater, et cetera, et cetera, so we don't forget any of the typical genres. But also, I don't think it's possible to talk about these things and address the Asian Canadian gaze without having some kind of activism there, because there's always the exploration of identity, where your culture is in this larger landscape that is Canada, right? So I would say the Rice Paper is more of a soft activism. The goal then was through entertaining and giving people a chance to write and maybe talking about important issues in a soft way, it's introducing and educating people in a way that is more palatable, right? If you're not of a mind to be a out there activist, because sometimes it can take a lot of courage to be an activist. We're saying, hey, by the way, we need room and we need to have a voice too.
Yeah, I think that's especially important in the sphere of like a lot of anti-Asian sentiment at the time. It must have felt scary to be in that direct activism space. So I think it's very important that Rice Paper was doing that sort of work of soft activism too.
Yeah, Jim was very careful to not go too far into activism. There's nothing wrong with activism, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. To be clear. I think he just wanted to remember that there's activism and then there's culture development.
Yeah.
And you exist as a community and your culture is part of your community, right? But if no one's documenting and no one's allowing you the room to express yourself, then it's almost as though the culture doesn't quite exist. Mm-hmm. That was his view. And so I think rice paper existed for that purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. So from the panel, you kind of talked a little bit about finding stories from that sort of tension between a story and its storyteller. And I was just wondering, in the process of choosing which works to get featured in Rice Paper, mm-hmm, were there any particular authors or stories that were specifically true to this quote?
Yeah, so I think I'll talk a little bit about the process and now I'll go into the quote part. So the process, I think a lot of the, during the panel I mentioned, a lot of the times the submissions that came in were of three kinds, right? Like usually there's identity searching, who am I, why am I here, why me, that kind of thing. That's important because, you know, that's very much part of the psyche of the community. But at the same time, I think Jim and I wanted the content to hit a couple points. Mm-hmm. Because our goal was to legitimize, document history, and then bring something that was a little bit more alternative, it's not that we're alternative, but just simply it wasn't documented a lot, mm-hmm, into more of a mainstream awareness. And a lot of stuff that was coming in then wasn't necessarily always in publishable form, because if you're Asian, typically your parents will be telling you to become a doctor, lawyer, mm-hmm, engineer, or something. And so not a lot of us were going in and taking writing schools or, mm-hmm, you know, visual artists. So I think when he and I went through the process of picking it, it was a combination of factors, right? You could either be, you know, in a form that is perfect because they're just a talented writer and great, but often that wasn't the case. And Jim would focus more on a good story. So I think that's where the tension quote comes in. So sometimes a person may come in with a very good story, or maybe they're a very interesting background, like a documentarian who's talking about something that has to be, you know, put out there, but no one's ever talked about it before. Maybe they're not the best writer. Right, that has a lot of worth and merit. It goes in. Or it could be there's this new artiste who's developing a new form of art. Mm-hmm. And as it shows the development of these intersections of genres, that's interesting too, because it shows Asian Canadians are experimenting. So that would have some merit. History. So, for example, I think we have Anna May Wong, right? She was like the original siren of this cinema in the 30s. We had like Long Tak Sum, who was a neuromancer. He was kind of like the Houdini of his times. Mm-hmm. But most people don't know about that. And Jim felt it was very important to bring awareness because he wanted to show that Asian Canadian culture wasn't just a thing from this century. Mm-hmm. It's been in North America for a long, long time, right? So it shows that history and longevity of how this culture has evolved, and that was important. So this combination of all these things, and as I said before, if it wasn't always in publishable format, then our mandate as a magazine also was to mentor writers and to help those voices develop. Mm-hmm. So this was where a lot of his mentoring worked with me, and I think because I was also trained as a writer, it was possible for me to figure out how to coax the story into life. Mm-hmm. Jim and I would sometimes have arguments about this because he would say, okay, hey, make this happen. I was like, what, how? But anyway, I think sometimes when it comes to tension between the storyteller and the actual story, it may not be the story that the storyteller wants to tell or sets mm-hmm. out to tell. There's a few things going on, right? Especially if you're editing a magazine. Mm-hmm. You need the story that you publish to be something that fits the mandate of your publication. Mm-hmm. You also need the story to at least be representative of the voice of the magazine. When I say voice, I don't mean Asian Canadian voice only, right? Though that's important. I meant every publication, like, for example, Esquire, Geist, GQ, there's a certain voice that is prevalent throughout the entire magazine in terms mm-hmm. of tone.
Yeah.
So that's also important. So you need to know if this writer is able to work with you on making that happen. Mm-hmm. And then you need to know if that story can be coaxed out, right? Maybe you're telling the writer the story should be about A, and they're like, well, no, I want to tell B and only B. Mm-hmm. So that tension then becomes a tension between the writer and the editor as well. But it can be that tension that brings out the most interesting stories. So, for example, there was this filmmaker. She was native Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably one of the most compelling stories I've ever had the honor of editing. But so she had lived with her mixed heritage for her entire life. And I think when the story was submitted to us, it was in 2004, and she had just come out about her dual heritage in 2002. So that was a fairly recent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very raw and sensitive topic, especially when you consider the natives and the Chinese, our history, it's not a very happy one, right? Because the natives had the Indian Act, we had the Exclusion Act, and basically you're talking about two marginalized communities with parallel suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And from her mom's side on native, her dad's side on Chinese, like, it's just a lot of suffering and silence. You got to treat this very delicately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the story that came to us was maybe in a rougher form. It was beautiful, but it would have been akin to reading someone's stream of consciousness, slightly more structured, of course, than that, but
mm-hmm.
in someone's very private personal diaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as an editor, you have to ask yourself, right, is there is a narrative that has to be told with that?
Mm-hmm.
How do I honor that? How do I work with this person to develop that? And I think you also have to ask yourself, maybe it's better to leave an original format. Maybe the readers do want to read that, but then it may not go with what I said, the voice, the overall mm-hmm. tone of the magazine. Or maybe it's too raw, such that the readers who would read it may not be as open and receptive to the topic as if we had taken some time to turn it into a more fleshed out article in a different way, right? Because you always have to give some context of the history.